Those of you on Zoom vastly outnumber those of us in the Zendo today. We are three people, which often tends to happen after a one-day retreat. And now it looks like you guys are, that's 21 on Zoom so far. So I will begin by greeting those of you on Zoom, and then those of us in the Zendo will say hi. Start with Bob, Zach, Paulette, Christina, Karen, Alice, Mary, Bri, I'm guessing I've got that right, Chris, Ellen, Vin, Brian, Dennis, Etzido, Betty, Pat, Choketsu, Tyler, Yeshitsoki, Mark, Ruth Ann, and I think that's Andy. Yes, Andy. And in the Zendo, Dave, Jim, and Domio. All right. I guess in terms of announcements, consider participating in the term student program, which the retreat, Saturday retreat at the end of February is the term student opening retreat. And you tie together the term with a set of personal vows, and there's a closing retreat, I believe it's middle of May, to wrap things up. And we support one another through the through that period of time. It's a constant cohort of people. Okay. Is there any questions about that stuff or anything else that I should mention? All right. A few people have been inquiring about studying re and receiving the precepts. So our precept ceremony, our ceremony of formally becoming a Zen Buddhist, will be Sunday, June 5th. And so we will be doing our annual precept study for 10 weeks before that. And we'll be doing it on Tuesdays, Tuesday evenings. And a couple people have mentioned, who are on the East Coast and find those. We have some intrepid souls that join us for Tuesday evening. But if that's too late, the Thursday study group that Victor and Marv and a handful of folks participate in regularly, and they usually discuss the podcast, and they meet a little earlier, so it's like 4 p.m. Pacific time, so it's an earlier time, still in the evening for those of you on the East Coast. And he said they are happy to study the precepts before June 5th as well. So if Tuesday evenings don't work for you, that's a great way to get into an actual interactive precept study on Thursdays instead. And we'll be reading the book by Diane Rosetto, Waking Up to What You Do. And different people will be leading those precept classes. Different people have received the precepts in the past, but and they might draw from different sources, but generally speaking, we'll try to stay grounded in that one text together this time. All right. I guess I'll begin. So, as I mentioned in the newsletter write-up for this talk, I was going to start off with just an open Q&A about physical discomfort during Zazen, because we didn't get a chance to do that last week. I gave the talk on physical discomfort and none of the psychological aspects of it, but also practical things you can do about it. And if you are interested, my podcast this last week was on that, and my next podcast episode will also be on that and going into a little more detail than I did in the Dharma talk. But in the meantime, I wanted to open it up if there, and then I'll be going into other unpleasant or frustrating things that might happen in Zazen that might make us less likely to sit. But in the meantime, any questions about physical posture, discomfort?
Domi, I have a question.
Yeah.
I often find that sitting like what I think is the right posture, like head, you know, chin back and straight up and down, is more uncomfortable than kind of slouching over and maybe my head's a little crooked. But I find like this pretty comfortable physically. Do you think we should kind of shoot for upright, being more upright and being more textbook perfect, or is it okay to kind of slop it up a little bit?
Well, I think to one extent our body tells us what's right, right? If we can hold a posture, you know, very still for a prolonged period and we don't end up uncomfortable, it's probably not a bad posture in that sense. However, I mean, usually the kind of slouching that many of us would do, when you mentioned that term, isn't very sustainable. Like, it's not actually all that comfortable. If you pay attention after a little while, what we're actually doing is like fidgeting. But let's say a certain kind of slouchiness compared to what you think you're supposed to be sitting seems to be more comfortable. And then I guess I would say, pay attention to what the posture does to your mind. Because our posture really, let's just say there was a point in my practice where I felt, you know, in those tough middle monk years, where it just felt so bleak and so despairing that I could not sit up straight. I couldn't sit any other way, which I think is really telling, you know, whereas if we're excited about something, you know, this is the posture we have. So paying attention to what it does to your mind, and then I guess opening the question about, is there a way to sit erect that's other than how you might think? You know, sometimes I think our ideas, once we have a model in our mind and we're trying to fit it, we're going to generally be too rigid and stiff, and that's not really what it's supposed to be. It's supposed to be more, I mean, really, you know, it's useful to think about this posture as being an asana, being a yoga position, which it is. That, you know, just how you would in yoga, and if you're taking a posture, you know, you're putting energy into it, you're holding it, you're exploring it, it's alive, as opposed to ideally that's what we do when we're sitting as well, which is kind of a interesting thing to explore. Oh, so there you go. Helpful.
Yeah, thank you.
Typical kind of vague yes and no and button ant kind of
sentence. It's useful. Thank you.
Yeshe Itzoki.
I had a thought to possibly add to that. That sometimes when we're sitting upright and holding ourselves upright, we are in a more rigid posture, and we're not releasing our energy down into the earth, into gravity, so that our pelvis and our lower body is actually a foundation and a support holding us upright. So we don't really have to hold ourselves upright. We need to just let go and nestle into gravity, root down into gravity, so that our spine just and our head can be held upright. Mm. I don't know if that makes any sense.
Yeah, you're reminding me of, I mean, I don't know what Feldenkrais says about this, but, you know, Alexander technique, as I always try to keep in mind, I didn't do a lot of it, but it one of their key things is let the neck be long. Not make it long, but, you know, most of the time we're kind of going like this, is let it. So it's exploring this, you know, relationship with our body. How do we allow it to be upright without actually using our small muscles to try to hold it that way?
That made me think of two other things. And one is that our head should feel like it's floating on top of our spine, that we're not really holding it up. And we had one exercise with one person holding their hand underneath, the other person holding on top. It's hard to show in Zoom. And then walking around, and the one person would hold themselves upright like this. And it's very hard for this support person underneath to know, well, where are you going to be? Where are you going to be? Because they were holding themselves off of the support. But you don't want to crash down into it. But there's a lovely balance of connection. Hmm. Where this can support you and this nestles like a cup and saucer.
Thank you.
I'm a physical therapist. Sorry.
Go ahead.
I'm a physical therapist, and the spinal posture in Zazen is actually a really good one, Zach. I know it causes discomfort. It causes me discomfort as well. I hold myself really tight. My muscles just like bind up because I'm guarded both internally and externally. But, you know, there's a part in your brain, like what Domio says, where like your brain says, okay, this is uncomfortable, but I know it will be good. it's weird. It's like getting like a tough, like hard massage, kind of like it hurts, but you know, it hurts so good. it is really weird. But then with time, like, as you break barriers of discomfort, you find it much easier to sit up straighter each time the more you try. And then that plumb line really, like, you know, acting tall, your spine suddenly starts to gain endurance and strength to hold yourself up, and you no longer have to slouch. So it's kind of like a really good benefit in the long run too. Consider it an exercise.
But I know that sometimes, you know, particularly because if you do a meditation retreat, then whatever mistakes you're making are going to cause a lot of discomfort by the time you get to, you know, day two or three. And so sometimes I've noticed, I'll think like you do, like, oh, this is so uncomfortable, I'm going to slouch. And then I kind of let myself slouch. But then I just hold that position for a little bit and I ask, is that really slouching? Because in some ways it's not. Like, if you probably wouldn't even know the difference looking at me from outside. I'm just letting go of some tension. So, like, you know, here's my shoulders held the way that I think they should be, right? And here's like slouching my shoulders, which is probably closer to what really I should be doing anyway. Paulette?
Yeah, I used to sit really like ramrod straight, almost to the point where my spine was like, I don't know, not really straight. It was like curving forward, like almost hyperextending it.
Hyperextended, yeah.
Yeah, so I actually like to do a little rounding in the lower spine and like a little slouching, because it just feels like I'm more in my body. I'm not like this. And, you know, I used to think this is where the way we were supposed to sit, and it's not comfortable.
What I tell my patients is like, pretend that there's like a little string at the top of your head and a puppet master is just kind of lifting you up a little bit. So you're not like tilted back, but you're actually just getting taller. And surprisingly, that kind of like accentuates, well, not accentuates, but it like neutralizes the spine instead of being, you know, you're just...
Any other questions about physical? Mary.
Myself here. My experience has been, as I've gotten older, that it was harder to sit on the zafu. Is that the word for it? And so I began experimenting with the chair and then also with the bench on the floor. And I think it's worth experimenting because each one of those is very different in terms of what it offers your body to experience. I ended up liking actually the bench quite a lot. Your knees have to take it though. That's part of the process, but experiment, I think, because you might be surprised that one might feel a little more comfortable than the other.
Yeah. An experiment in terms of like, how high is the chair? Do you sit,
yes,
how far forward on the chair do you sit? Do you have a,
yes,
cushion under you?
Yeah.
There's different heights of benches. Should you put a cushion on the bench? Da, da, da. Should you sit with your legs close together or further apart?
Yes.
So yeah, it's definitely worth experimenting. And, you know, I think if you do need to move to a bench or to a chair or something, there are challenges to those postures as well. So a lot of times I'm sitting on a cushion cross-legged and I'll do that through most of a long retreat, but that's not because like I'm a glutton for punishment. That's because I couldn't sit. If I sat on a bench, my knees would hurt a lot more.
Yeah.
And a different part of my back would hurt a lot more. And if I sat in a chair, other parts would hurt, you know, it's not quite as, good for your spine, you know, kind of, unless you're really, you know, sitting on a cushion and you're essentially just using it for the height and you're not leaning back. So there's discomfort to be dealt with in every one of these postures.
Thank you.
I was gonna, I have a different perspective from the PT, and I guess I'm just looking at the trees here. They send their roots down into the earth, then they come upright. They don't start upright and work at it and then send their roots down. They have gravity on their side rather than working through pain or discomfort. Anyway.
Well, and it all depends on which framing, you know, works for you, whether it's yoga or whether it's the, you know, visualization of the, you know, string that goes to the ceiling, which I've heard, or more energetic and organic, that sense of groundedness with the earth. And I don't, you know, thank goodness there are different ways to approach these things. So that experiment with those as well, not just in terms of what you actually physically change, but how you approach it. Jim, did you have something?
I was just going to chime in that during a long retreat, I find that, you know, if I just try to sit on a cushion the entire time, that, you know, I make it partway through and then I can't sit at all. And I've taken to essentially alternating periods, sitting on a cushion, sitting on a sitting in a chair. So
yeah, that's a great approach. So a lot of times, you know, sit on a cushion, then sit on a chair for the second meditation period or whatever. Tyler.
Hi. I was just curious. I've kind of read a lot of different opinions, or a couple, I guess, one of two different opinions about the importance of like, is trying to sit in lotus or half lotus a worthwhile goal? Like, I can't, I just, but I've considered like starting to learn some stretches and trying to get there. but I just don't know if this is even really like a worthwhile kind of push of my time, or if just sitting cross-legged is just fine. And yeah, just curious what your thoughts were.
If you're sitting cross-legged and you feel like your zazen is, you know, that you're comfortable enough and you're stable enough, you know, great. I guess nothing needs to be fixed. If in that posture you experience discomfort, you know, particularly if you're gonna sit for a while and you're in a retreat or something like that, then I would say, you know, you might experiment with, you know, there's little things you can do in between, right? You can kind of prop your foot up on a pillow so it's kind of almost into the quarter lotus, and you could do that for a little while and then let it go. Because I mean, again, this whole posture thing, what, you know, is designed to be very comfortable and good for you and sustainable. So I've never been able to do full lotus, but that is an incredibly, you know, stable, balanced posture. That is like your body is holding itself up with an absolute minimum of effort. So in a way it's ideal, right? Except that there's certain parts of us that aren't flexible enough to do it, our hips or our ankles. So, you know, half, I do quarter because I find that much more comfortable than Burmese, which is one leg in front of the other. So if you find any need whatsoever, you might just give it a try and ease into it, because you might end up finding it actually more comfortable in an ironic way once you are capable of doing it.
Just to add a little bit, Tyler, like some people just have a limited joint capsule mobility, so their hips are oriented in a certain way, either retroverted or introverted, and some people are just not able to cross their legs. And you shouldn't try, because you'll end up having a labral tear or something more serious. So generally from the pelvis down, if you are not able to get into a certain position or let your knees fall to the side, then either experiment with a different posture or put pillows underneath the knees so that you can still kind of like not totally flat, but like, you know, V-shaped. So yeah, you're like, I say from the pelvis down, there are certain joint capsules that just won't allow you to move. But from the pelvis up, we're meant to be pretty mobile. So, you know, like in response to Yeshe, yeah, I fix people from the top, and I also fix people from the bottom. So it just depends on like what mentally works for you on your posture, whether you feel like, you know, centering your bowl of your pelvis works, or whether centering your head works. Either way is fine. Just wanted to add, since we're on
You reminded me also, so first of all, that's a great tip about just if you do want to sit cross-legged and your knees don't touch the ground, just, you know, stick some support cushions under them, because you can still benefit from that posture, but you're not straining as much to, you know, keep your legs aloft. But also another warning is in terms of if you're trying to sit cross-legged and you have knee pain, always remember, and it's tricky to demonstrate on Zoom, but if this is your leg, right, you should like bend your knee and then move it into that posture. Don't go into this posture and then try to torque your knee. Your knee bends only in one plane, like this. So bend the knee first and then see what kind of cross-legged posture you can get. But don't like, you know, wrench your leg up and try to do that. All right. Any more? Go ahead, Ruth.
I love the challenge in Zazen because it's body awareness. And for me, my indicator that my thoughts are like video going by is when the hand posture, which is so comfortable and simple to do, when my hands are no longer as they should be, then I think, okay, where have I gone? You know, come back, find the breath. And that's a good thing. And the times I'm in the zone, I cannot differentiate the left palm from the right. I mean, it's just the warmth of the hands, just almost the arms too, just that warmth of that upper part of my body. And that's kind of a beautiful, you know, space, but that doesn't happen all the time. But when my hands kind of collapse, then I think, okay, let's go back.
Yeah.
So this
great,
is good.
Great reminder. And there's the demonstrating the posture, right? So that's the mudra that we have. The thumbs are lightly touching. And then I usually find myself going like this when I'm thinking about a lot of stuff. You start drifting off, they go like this. So it's a nice feedback loop to how your mind is. Any other? I mean, there's, I'm sure the like questions of physical discomfort come up all the time. So, you know, by all means, just if you have an issue coming up, you can talk to me, or, you know, when you're off in your social breakout rooms, mention it to other people. They might have good tips for how they've dealt with it. You know, our Saturday morning Sangha check-in can always talk a little bit about this stuff. So there's no need to suffer in silence. All right. I doubt I'm going to get through everything that I prepared for today now. But that's okay. Maybe I'll just, you know, roll it over into yet another Dharma talk. So unpleasant or frustrating experiences in Zazen other than physical discomfort, things that might make you less likely to sit. So I brainstormed a list that I'm going to share. And then I'll invite you to, I think it's pretty exhaustive. A couple of them are essentially categories under which various kinds of unpleasant things can fit. But if there's anything that I've missed, I want you to let me know. All right. So I have drowsiness and dullness. I have, so I'm trying to make the Zoom, see more Zoom people as I'm doing this. Troubling emotions, including activation of past trauma. Perseverating on upsetting situations or negative thoughts. Makyo, which is a relatively uncommon phenomenon of unusual or mildly hallucinatory sensations or perceptions, energetic disturbances or involuntary physical movements. So it's like, when I talk about that, realize it's not something we mention that often, because certain people can get a little fixated on it, like that sounds exciting and maybe that means that my meditation's going well, or, you know, when, like, it's kind of, we want to de-emphasize it. It's not our goal, but it is something that happens, and, you know, we're just encourage people not to freak out about it, but not to get fixated on it either. Something that I'm calling blender mind, which is just the experience of just rapid, more or less random succession of thoughts, which is agitating, not because of the content, but because the thought process just seems so out of control. Boredom, losing a sense of focus, purpose, willingness, motivation, and then frustration with your meditation, whether you blame yourself or the method or both. So, anybody think, I can't promise to get to it today, but anybody think of anything that, or wondering where it might fit within this list? Unpleasant or frustrating experiences in Zazen, things that make you not want to sit.
I think for me, there's a lot of restlessness, like the feeling of time slipping away and going, I gotta do this task, I gotta do that task.
Yeah. I wonder, would you call that an unpleasant experience in Zazen or just like competing priorities? I don't know. I mean, I guess in that sense, I might put that under boredom in the sense that, you know, we might have a sense that our Zazen's kind of a waste of time relative to all this other stuff that we need to be doing. Etsudo. You're still muted. There you go.
Can you hear me now? Yeah. So, you know, I think this is a great topic, and I've been very encouraged kind of in the mindfulness movement that there is this movement toward trauma-informed teaching. You know, and certainly I think trauma is a different kettle of fish in terms of what people bring to the practice. And there are certainly case reports of mental breakdowns during retreat, and people who have more serious mental health crises that are kind of brought on by their practice, you know. It's interesting, in the one day sit yesterday, I was thinking about a song that kind of came to me toward the end, and it was a song by, I forget his name, is it Todd Petty, who says, I'm free and I'm free falling, you know, that one? So there was certainly there's a part of my meditation where that sense of self does drop away. And that can be very freeing in the sense that I'm free from that tyrant of the storyteller and the drama of the internal process. And so that's the free part of that. And that can be very positive, but the free falling part, it can feel like a free fall. Where you don't have the groundedness in the routine markers of who you are and what you are. And that can be quite disturbing. And in psychological literature, we call that depersonalization. And it's a common problem in meditators. So that can be something I think that can happen, that can be a little bit disturbing as you engage in that not thinking that Dogen inspires us to. You can really really see clearly the construct itself and drop it away. And that can really feel like a free fall that can be very uncomfortable for some people. So I think that's one thing you could put in the list there would be depersonalization.
Yeah.
And certainly in the psychological literature, that's pathologized, but you know, I think in our practice, you know, it's foundational that we see the construct itself, and that's part of our path and part of our practice. But it can feel like a free fall at times, and that can be a very difficult experience. So I think this is great work in kind of teasing out some of the perils of meditation and Zazen.
Thank you. So I added that I think it's valuable to think of there being really, you know, the mental health issues kind of overlapping a couple different areas. And, you know, the more emotional activation of past trauma and trauma being held in the body and being awoken by that, you know, might fall into the troubling emotions part. But there's that other level of that the change in perception and sense of self, which to some extent you need a very help. What I've heard from folks in the know is you actually really want to have a very resilient sense of self when going into this, because it should not be about fracturing or dissolving your sense of self. It should be about transcending your sense of self. It's about seeing that's not all there is to it, not depriving you of the basic, narrative skills that we have of trying to hold our lives together. So thank you for that. I will just get started on what I have, and we'll see how far we get. Maybe I'll just, pause after each topic, and then, chances are we will return to this on another talk. And just out of curiosity, if I do that, do you want me to do that next weekend, or do you want me to talk about something else next weekend and return to this afterwards? Is there anybody out there who's a little tired of talking about Zazen and wants me to talk about something else next week? All right, cool. All right. So let me start off with one of my favorites, or one of my least favorites, drowsiness and dullness. So I'm approaching this as there's kind of a spectrum, right, of dullness. Just if the ideal Zazen in a way is very alert and energized and engaged, then dullness is kind of the opposite of that, right? Not very alert, not very engaged. And then, for some of us, if that gets quite extreme, then we just slide off into sleep. And my experience, especially in the early years of practice, was I had, apparently, my body and mind had two modes. It was on or off. So either I was running around doing stuff, and when I stopped doing that, it's like my body and mind was just like, we're done. Like there's nothing to pay attention to here, no reason to stay awake. And it was, I obviously love Zen Buddhism, right? I, got really involved in practice. I eventually got ordained. But the first many, many years of sitting, I was just like this, just bobbing, just barely staying. I envy those people who can sleep without bobbing. They are there. It was just like this. And I would go to retreats, and that would be every meditation period for the first several days. I mean, several days of doing this and trying hard, right? Like then I'm trying to wake up, and it was very frustrating. And I would say, the first word that springs to mind is humiliating, but I should probably say more humbling, right? Trying to let go of what other people think. But that was like, it's a very public limitation, right? From afar, nobody can see that your mind is full of thoughts, but they can see that you're falling asleep. So this isn't exactly physical discomfort. It's not that uncomfortable, but same way as I was talking about the physical discomfort phenomenon, it always has a physical and psychological aspect. So there is and can be a physical aspect to sleepiness and Zazen. Many of us do not get enough sleep. When I was falling asleep in Zazen like that, I was getting about 6 hours of sleep a night. That's what my junior monkhood allowed me. And if I get 9 hours of sleep a night, I don't fall asleep in Zazen. But that's a big difference. So the amount of sleep we get, you know, it can increase the likelihood that you're going to fall asleep. So there's that. But the psychological aspect of it, of course, is that we can experience sleepiness even when well rested. And I always think of this, we'd be extremely unlikely to fall asleep if we knew this was our last day on Earth. If this was the last Zazen period I was ever going to sit, I would not be sleeping through it, even if I hadn't slept well for days, right? So there's a psychological aspect to engagement. So when I was practicing at a monastery once and struggling with sleepiness, and some experienced practitioner said something to me that was quite annoying, but also intriguing. And she said, if you fall asleep in Zazen, it's because you want to. And it was like, oh, it's like, and I believe there's a physical aspect to it, and that's beyond our, you know, except getting more sleep. But to some extent, there's some truth to this, but just because we know there's a physical component doesn't mean that we can just fix it. That's not how we work. There are physical, psychological components to all kinds of aspects of our experience, and that doesn't mean we can just instantly change them or fix them or understand them. So my recommendations, if you are one of those who struggles with sleepiness, and if you can fight it directly, more power to you. There are different, you know, I've had people recommend take deep breaths, you know, sit up. Keeping your eyes open can help. There's even this, clearly monks have struggled with this through the ages, right? This is apparently why tea was brought to China, because monks needed to stay awake while meditating. But there was one about like imagining a pat of butter on your head and imagine it slowly melting. And like, I don't know if that's supposed to distract you or something and keep you awake, but never worked for me. So if you've tried things and it doesn't help, then sit as best you can and allow the sleepiness to pass when it's time for it to pass. Which can be very frustrating, but it's an attitude of acceptance and humility, but also not just checking out, right? It's not just saying, well, screw it, I can't meditate. It's saying, well, hopefully this will pass at some point. And when it does, I'll try to be more awake. As you never know when you'll wake up. Sometimes I'll be drowsy and then we'll do Kinhin and then the next period of meditation is fine. And I'm not the only, you know, one who has this attitude about sleepiness. My teachers never gave me a hard time about it. I would go to meet with them and I would be just like, I'm terrible, I can't meditate at all. And they're like, eh. They never seem to care. So, you know, there you go. And in 30 years of sitting, I've only been able to rouse myself directly out of sleepiness a handful of times. And I think it's instructive, not just about sleepiness, but about so many different aspects of our experience during Zazen and at other times. The only times that I was able to do this was when, and probably because I'd already been sitting for several days, I just wholeheartedly experienced the sleepiness. No resistance, but with a curiosity. Just, I totally was sleepiness. Noticing, where do I feel that? Noticing the, like, there's heaviness in the, you know, above the eye, and what is that? And there was just this engagement with it that, I don't know, it's like the body forgot to fall asleep because it was so intriguing to be sleepy. On a very practical note, if you do struggle with sleepiness, you might just try sitting at a different time of day. You might try getting more sleep. You might try, if you haven't already, sit in the morning instead of the evening, or the evening instead of the morning. Afternoons are generally not anyone's favorite time, but they might be for you. And then Ellen, I think you raised your hand during this segment.
So what's in the strictest definition of proper form for Zazen, is our eyes closed or eyes looking down 6 feet in front of you, is one preferable, or looking at a blank wall, which is not always possible, depending on where what you're trying to do and the direction you're facing? What are your feelings? And sleepiness isn't my primary obstacle, but I do find sometimes closing my eyes to be somehow I'm less distracted because I'm just looking at the back of my eyelids and not what's around me necessarily, or what's in front of me.
So I will close my eyes sometimes. And I think as long as we remain mindful of our experience and how the eyes closed or eyes open is affecting us, that, you know, kind of notice. I started to notice, like, when I started having weird, random thoughts not connected with reality, I'm drifting off into dreamland, you know. So I think, though, that it's good to aspire to really be able to sit with your eyes open, you know, to be very, very familiar with that practice. And then maybe sometimes you close your eyes. Sometimes I'll feel a little drowsy, and rather than fighting to keep the eyes open, I rest them. But then we need to keep our awareness grounded in this. So that's one of the things that our eyes open is, because sometimes we need to remember that we're not trying to avoid being distracted. There is no distraction from this. I mean, none of this is a distraction from this. This is the distraction, right? This is not. I mean, it's true sometimes for, you know, looking at a bookshelf or, you know, something that's too distracting and we can't really focus or something like that. So just the floor or a wall or something not detailed is a good thing to rest the eyes on. But I think it's, you know, in the depth of retreat, that is really comes through sitting there with the eyes open and just being there. And then at a certain point, I might close my eyes, and in that circumstance, it's very different. In that circumstance, it's like I am so connected to this moment and right here, that it's like opening and closing the eyes doesn't even matter. I just, you know, I'm breathing the room. I am part of the room. And then it is not so necessary to keep the eyes open. So let's see, on to, which one can I finish in like 5 minutes and let you have a couple questions? I'll save troubling emotions, because that one, there's a little more to that one. How about perseverating on upsetting situations or negative thoughts, which we can continue discussion about that next time as well. So this is, it depends on how bad this is. Every one of us decides for ourselves. So I'm going to be talking about this as well in terms of the troubling emotions, mental health issues, things like that. If something that's coming up in your Zazen is disturbing enough that it is interfering with your daily life, then you should get help. You should talk to a teacher, but you should probably also talk to a therapist. I mean, that the modern psychology, psychiatry has much better tools than Zen and meditation does for processing these things, for supporting you, for all of that. So definitely, you know, there's no weakness. That's part of practice, is to recognize when you need to not just do zazen. But let's assume then that, like, the perseverating that you're doing on upsetting situations, negative thoughts, harboring ill will and anger or whatever, isn't, you know, it's annoying, it's unpleasant, it's like crowding your zazen, but it's not life, you know, really wrecking your life. In that case, like most of what happens in zazen, it's just a matter of shining the light of awareness on it, of recognizing what's happening whenever you have the opportunity. rehearsing my, you know, making my case against this person that has, you know, done something to hurt me, or, and with some gentleness and persistence. So, and also to look at this as if it's somebody else's mind, if you can, as if you can't control the perseverating, and you're not even trying to, but you're just noticing, you know, that's, wow, you've spent the whole 30 minutes, you know, thinking about this thing over and over, worrying about this thing or planning this thing. And usually then we can start to recognize that how repetitive and stressful this thinking is, and that most of the time we're rehearsing responses to things that are extremely unlikely to unfold the way we think they will. We're catastrophizing, imagining scenarios that may or may not happen. And even if our thinking is fairly grounded and fruitful, we don't have to keep rethinking it over and over, right? We can, like, all right, we've got a plan, or, you know, we've got our assessment of what's happening. So if the perseverating continues, again, if it makes life difficult, then you should do something about it. The perseverating is a key feature of depression and anxiety and stuff like that. So keep an eye out for that. But, you know, sometimes if it's not all that bad, just talking it out, you know, with a friend or a fellow practitioner or a teacher is helpful. And in terms of your zazen, this is one of the few places where I recommend employing a directed effort meditative technique. And again, this is if it's really, you know, becoming a problem, more than one meditation period, a couple meditation periods or something. Because doing something, a directed effort meditative technique, like following the breath, counting the breath, you know, awareness of sound, a body scan, something like that, can just stop that perseverating. Now, I'm not recommending that as just like, oh, I have random thoughts and my mind wanders and I want to stop it from wandering. You know, again, fine if that's the kind of meditation you want to do. But shikantaza is not about trying to control what happens, but shining the light of awareness and letting things settle. But when we're on that the problem with the perseverating is that it's self-perpetuating. So this is something like, particularly when there's ill will involved, or if it's a depressive perseverating, it's like the more you go down that hole, the deeper the groove gets. And simply resting isn't probably going to make it stop, right? Because it's like the body's trying to, you know, convince you there is something wrong, or the world is a terrible place or something. in which case, then I do recommend spending some time doing one of those other types of meditation to just, you know, shift the mind out of that mode and, you know, get more grounded in the body, get more grounded in the moment, you know, take a few breaths free of that repeating narrative. I think, so that's that one. Any questions or comments, Brian?
So I realized when I was doing that I was also, you know, sort of defining the situation about which I was doing it as conflictual. I mean, this was kind of evolutionarily adaptive. I'm going into conflict. I'm girding my intellectual loins. I'm imagining this scenario and how to combat it, and that scenario and how to. And I realized that, you know, that's sort of, I'm not just anticipating the conflict, I'm almost ordaining it, because I'm only preparing myself for this particular kind of scenario. And so it seemed the antithesis of why I wanted to do the sitting, which was to be freer and to be more open to other possibilities and so on and so forth. So anyway, that was kind of helpful to appreciate that was exactly why I was kind of running down that particular rabbit hole. So, anyway.
And I think that's a good point, and that this is where our daily life practice and our meditation practice affect one another. So, you know, if we can manage to meditate and let go for a few moments and, you know, free ourselves from the perseverating or something, we can get some perspective. But also, over time, practicing in our daily life, we can pay attention with mindfulness and notice, you know, I perseverated for a week on this thing, and then it turned out completely different than I expected. Or like you said, you know, I kind of, you know, back myself into a corner with my perseverating, and then over time there ends up being some more points of choice, you know, where we say, what if I didn't rehearse this ahead of time? You know, what if I went in, tried to go in with a little bit less anticipation, how would that go? And then sometimes we're managed to do it a little bit, and then we go, oh, right. Actually, you know, our mind tells us, if you do that, you know, you need me working on your behalf nonstop. But through our experience, we can realize that we don't, and we don't need to worry as much. We can trust our capacities a little more. Yes, Shaitsoki.
Jogen, in a session I was in with him a while ago, he added a bit of humor. He says he was reading some statistics that he had read about how many times we say, look at the same thought over and over and over again. It's mind-boggling. I don't remember. It's a huge number. And he says, we spend all that time looking at the same thought over and over and over again. How boring is that? And so when I start ruminating, I just say, how boring is this? And that just helps me laugh my way out.
Thank you. All right. Well, here we are at 12:15. There's a lot more to discuss about various things that come up in Zazen. So I guess we'll just continue with that next week. Say the closing verse. Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water. The mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time. All honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas. Wisdom beyond wisdom. Maha Prajna Paramita. Thanks for coming, everyone.
Thank you. job